Thanks very much. It's a great pleasure to be here and talk about a topic actually that's meaningful to me personally, as it was interactions with two asthmatics with respiratory failure and that we had to struggle with mechanical ventilation when I was an intern that really, in a lot of ways, solidified my interest in pulmonary and critical care and kind of made me decide that this was the field for me. And even more meaningful, that the person at the bedside who really taught me everything I know about ventilating asthmatics was Dean Hess, and he will be the true expert in this presentation. But I've learned everything from him on this topic, so especially nice to present with him. The other great thing about this topic is that it's really devoid of any evidence-based medicine. So in the end, it ends up being anecdotal experience, my personal experience, quote-unquote expert opinion, for me, quote-unquote, for Dean, true expert opinion. And I think we've chosen, because this is a bit of an expert crowd, we've chosen to be a bit provocative in some of the things we talk about, really. And I'd like to keep it open, so if people want to stop us in between and talk about things we're saying, that's fine. But we'll talk some advanced topics, and for those of you who only do things based on evidence-based medicine, you can kick back and relax, because there really won't be much of that in any of this. So what we thought we'd talk very briefly on pathophysiology of life-threatening asthma, and I'll come back to that and why it's a little difficult to discuss this topic, but we'll make an attempt. Just a historical perspective, where Dean and I will just go through some of the important papers as we see it. Then Dean will talk about setting the ventilator and basic settings and approach from the ventilation standpoint. I'll talk about some ancillary therapies. We'll come back and just briefly touch on non-invasive ventilation. And then hopefully, if there's time, go through a couple cases where we can maybe open it up a bit and talk about management of these difficult patients. So just from a perspective, pathophysiology, one of the striking things for me is over the years, and I haven't been in this business too long, but long enough that it really is amazing how infrequently we now see, at least at the Mass General, and I assume it's the same here, asthmatics requiring mechanical ventilation. It was, I wouldn't say very frequent when I was a resident, but we would have one every month or so, whereas now if we have a few a year, it's a lot. So the idea that these patients represent a subset of asthma or a different pathophysiology, I think, you know, is not borne out by just the fact that we don't see it as much, and that the treatments we're using for our asthmatics in the outpatient setting, what Chris has been working hard on for years and years, is really probably making a difference in preventing a lot of these. Now, there are still pockets of areas where you do see a fair amount of this, and mainly in underserved areas, implying that it's a compliance issue or getting treatment to these people, and again arguing that it's really run-of-the-mill asthma that's just gone bad or not poorly treated or something has touched it off. Now, there is this idea that this is just part of a spectrum of acute severe asthma or life-threatening asthma, where, you know, this is a subset of asthmatics, somewhere around 10% of all asthmatics who come in, and they're going to be the ones that are going to have respiratory failure or be at higher risk for this. And there's no question that you can find risk factors that will identify those people, and being the strongest being prior mechanical ventilation or ICU admission or lots of hospitalizations. But even people who meet this ATS definition, which doesn't project that well, I'm sorry about that, of severe asthma, are people who are at increased risk, and then also people who are non-compliant, and then there are these reports of people who have a sudden, you know, walk into a pet store or something and have a sudden dramatic asthmatic attack. But the amazing thing is this only identifies less than half of the patients who present with this. So I think the big take-home point of this is that any asthmatic can come in with a severe flare and require mechanical ventilation. It's not a certain subset that we need to be extremely worried about, although you certainly should be more worried about these people, but anybody has the potential for this. When it comes to the pathobiology of it, and I know Sally Wenzel, and there's a big National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute group that's trying to kind of classify this acute severe asthma. Personally, I haven't seen much to really suggest anything more than just more severe asthma. The old autopsy studies, and I'll give you the reference for these in a second, really just look looked like its worst disease when they looked at the airways in people who died of asthma. So they had more airway edema. The airways in general were narrower. There was more remodeling, more smooth muscle cell hypertrophy. And then the real striking aspect, probably the most striking aspect, is the descriptions of the large mucus plugs. And I think they used to say you'd squeeze the lung and these things would come out like worms from the airways. Some horrible description like that. So, there is obviously more severe disease associated with people who die of asthma and probably who are presenting with severe asthma and requiring mechanical ventilation. Sally Wenzel has really started to look at the inflammatory thing you see in people who are brittle or harder to control. And what she sees is a few different, types of inflammation. One is persistent eosinophilic inflammation, and this is actually a patient of mine who was one of the few people I just could not get off oral corticosteroids despite high-dose inhaled corticosteroid, lots of ancillary therapies. And I was fairly inexperienced at the time, and my first thought was, well, it can't be asthma. So I took her, and this was on 30 or 40 of prednisone, and I biopsied her. And I remember Eugene Mark called me up and said, why are you biopsying a patient with asthma? And it's kind of usual tone. But that's what her airway looked like. And you can still see the eosinophils, these sort of reddish cells throughout the airway and other pieces too. There was sheets of them despite high-dose prednisone. And that's one of the things that Sally Wenzel has described. So clearly there's a group of people who are relatively steroid-resistant in their inflammatory response. They're not true steroid-resistant because she was cushionoid and had other signs of steroids, but just the eosinophilic inflammation was somehow resistant. She's also described a neutrophilic inflammation type where there seems to be a correlation, more neutrophils, more severe disease, and then there's a pauci-immune asthma. People have described physiology, people who don't notice their CO2 rising, things like that. But I haven't been really convinced that we can find a unifying pathobiologic premise for why people have life-threatening asthma. So I think we'll leave it at that. We can come back if people have questions. Other considerations, there are very rare people who have true corticosteroid resistance. That obviously is a problem. And then I think you always have to ask when you have someone who's just not responding to conventional therapy, is it something else? And I'm sure people could lengthen this list to 20 if we really thought about it. But some of the things I've been fooled by is constrictive bronchiolitis obliterans in patients who've been told they have asthma. COPD obviously is a common problem, which it can be less steroid responsive. Vocal cord dysfunction, we'll come back to, bronchiectasis, other airway diseases that just are going to be less are treated less effectively with the usual asthma therapies. When Dean and I got together and thought about this, it was months ago, Dean, right, when we started planning this. we thought about sort of the papers that really influenced us in thinking about this. And the interesting thing, and this doesn't necessarily mean that I stopped reading back in the 90s, that they all tend to be older papers. The first two are the pathology studies that looked at, described in fatal asthma, what you see, and are nice studies to review. Darioli and Perret, I'm sure I'm saying their names wrong, wrote a really fantastic paper in the 80s which described permissive hypercapnia in the management of asthmatics, which is now the standard. At the time, seemed quite provocative. Tuxin wrote a very influential paper, actually a series of papers. This is one of them, which really, I think, put air trapping on the map as a problem in mechanical ventilation and discussed an interesting technique, which we actually used to do fairly frequently when I started managing these patients. It requires them really to be paralyzed, so we do it much less, where you just measure all the trapped gas in the patient by putting in a 60-second exhalation time and collect all the gas. Obviously, can be difficult in an asthmatic. But if they, I think their volume was more than 20 mil per kilo, those were the ones who were at higher risk for barotrauma. We won't discuss that because I don't think we've done it in a long time, Dean. I haven't, certainly. But still worth reading and knowing about. Leatherman and Rosenkrantz, and I think we'll come back to this, introducing the concept of occult peep. Just as if occult peep wasn't enough, you have to have occult peep. Ranieri, who I don't know if he ever published the data, he presented in here talking about setting PEEP in asthmatics. I thought this was an excellent review discussing that. And then Leatherman coming back to the idea of occult PEEP and how, this is something that you just often can't get rid of despite very aggressive measures. So good papers to review. We'll go over some of these points. in the presentation. So before I hand it over to Dean for discussion about mechanical ventilation, I just want to touch briefly on indications for intubation. I know for this crowd this is probably less of a sticking point, but when residents or inexperienced people think about this, I think it's one of the more difficult decisions in an asthmatic, partly because these people tend to be young, otherwise healthy individuals and will tolerate a fair amount of respiratory distress before they collapse and you know, have agonal respirations. This is obviously an easy decision when it's up here. But, you know, these people can have quite high CO2s and be quite acidotic, breathing away, talking to you with maybe one or two word sentences, obviously in a lot of distress, but look okay. And the question is, when do you intubate and pull the trigger? Obviously, you want to do it before they collapse and arrest on you. But it can be a very difficult decision. And I know in the ED, we're now taught it's a clinical decision. You don't need blood gases. And I largely agree with it. But this is the one time where I think initial blood gas, looking at where they are, and if the CO2 is in that sort of high mid-40s, that's very worrisome. But you don't have to pull the trigger and treat these patients, you know, and you can treat these patients, see if they turn around. But then if the values are getting worse, that's someone obviously who, when you check after three NEBs or whatever, that's someone obviously who I'm worried about and thinking about intubating earlier. In the old days, these people are very easy to nasotracheally intubate because they basically suck down the tube, but you obviously want to avoid that for risks of sinusitis and nasal polyps. So if you can, orotracheal preferred in these people. And in the old days, before the rapid sequence intubations became so common in the ED, we'd often just switch the tube once they got up to the MICU. So I'll give it over to Dean Hess to discuss the ventilation, and we'll bounce back and forth at this point.
It's always fun to bounce back and forth with Ben. I think I first met you when you were an intern, and Ben is one of those interns and residents and fellows who always asked me questions that required me to learn a lot. So he's taught me a lot just by the questions he's asked me. And over the years, many of these thoughts I think we have developed together, and we've shared with one another and other groups such as this over the last 10 years or so. So what are our goals then when setting the ventilator in a patient with asthma? Well, first and foremost, what we want to do is to minimize the amount of air trapping. And in fact, much of what I'll be talking with you about this morning has to do with managing air trapping and auto-PEEP and dynamic hyperinflation when ventilating patients with asthma. We also want to avoid overdistension. We want to avoid plateau pressures greater than about 30 centimeters of water. How we avoid overdistension is in large degree by avoiding or minimizing air trapping. So to the extent that we can decrease the amount of auto-PEEP, we can decrease the risk of overdistension injury. We want to provide an adequate oxygenation. I would suggest an oxygen saturation of about 90%, and provide an adequate ventilation. And note that adequate ventilation here is not normal ventilation. And Ben and I, without evidence, suggest a pH of greater than 7.20. The point being that attempts to normalize the pH can result in greater risk of air trapping and auto-PEEP and overdistension lung injury. So what about specific ventilator settings? Now, whether you choose to use pressure-controlled ventilation or volume-controlled ventilation, I think many times will depend upon what your biases are as a clinician or what the biases are of the institution and the unit where you work. There are both advantages and disadvantages of one approach over the other, and in fact, I'll expand a little bit more on that on the next slide. Again, we want to set the ventilator to avoid air trapping and auto-PEEP. Relatively short inspiratory time, an inspiratory time initially of about 1 second. We achieve that by using a high inspiratory flow setting on the ventilator and using a constant or a square wave inspiratory flow rather than a descending ramp flow pattern, because a descending ramp flow pattern will prolong the inspiratory time. Relatively slow respiratory rate of around 10 to 12 breaths per minute and a tidal volume of around 6 to 8 mLs per kilogram of predictive body weight. Note that these types of settings will tend to maximize the expiratory time, and by maximizing the expiratory time, we can decrease the risk of air trapping and auto-PEEP. Again, whether we use volume control or pressure control ventilation, We want to avoid overdistension lung injury by keeping the plateau pressure less than 30 centimeters of water. So in these patients then, we want to monitor the plateau pressure on regular intervals, and we also want to monitor the auto PEEP on regular intervals. Now the setting of PEEP has to do with whether or not we are able to counterbalance any auto PEEP that the patient has. And I'll talk in some detail in a minute about the use of PEEP to counterbalance auto PEEP in these patients. However, there are some patients, as we will see, where attempts to counterbalance auto PEEP simply drive up the total level of PEEP for the patient and drive up the peak inspiratory pressure and the plateau pressure. And in those cases, we may want to avoid auto PEEP. And in fact, some patients that Ben and I have managed, we've managed on a PEEP setting of zero, because any increase in PEEP simply would drive up the amount of overdistension. And again, we set the FiO2 to maintain an adequate oxygen saturation of around 90%. Now, what about the issue of pressure control versus volume control ventilation? There are advantages and disadvantages of either approach. If we use volume control ventilation, we can maintain the minute ventilation even if the patient increases the amount of auto PEEP or air trapping. However, if on volume ventilation, if the patient develops more auto PEEP, more air trapping, it increases the risk of overdistension, because on volume control ventilation, auto PEEP will drive up the plateau pressure and the peak inspiratory pressure. If we use pressure control ventilation, on the other hand, it decreases the risk of overdistension with an increased amount of air trapping, because the peak pressure cannot exceed the pressure setting on the ventilator. However, the price that we pay here is a loss of tidal volume and minute ventilation and respiratory acidosis if the patient develops more air trapping. Now, my own bias is in these patients to use volume control ventilation, because I think it can be very tricky to use pressure control ventilation in these patients. And I have personally been burned a few times where we've tried to be clever with the use of pressure control ventilation. And if the pressure control on the ventilator equals the amount of auto PEEP that the patient has, the patient's minute ventilation will become essentially zero. And after a few experiences trying to manage severe asthmatics on the ventilator with pressure control ventilation and finding that the patient developed more air trapping and lost their minute ventilation, became severely acidotic, I have tended to try to be less clever with pressure control and just stick to volume control ventilation. But again, I think you can use either approach, and you can use in the hands of a skilled clinician, you could use either approach. Now, shown here is a typical airway pressure graphic during volume control ventilation, where this is the level of PEEP, which is set on the ventilator. During the inspiratory phase, the pressure increases up to the peak inspiratory pressure. And then if we apply an end inspiratory breath hold, or a period of zero flow at the end of ventilation, we can measure the plateau pressure. And the plateau pressure, as we have all been taught, reflects the peak alveolar pressure at end inhalation. But I think it's important to appreciate that the plateau pressure actually represents the average alveolar pressure. And there are likely some lung units that have alveolar pressures or plateau pressures greater than what we measure with this maneuver, and some that have plateau pressures, or some units that have plateau pressures and alveolar pressures less than the plateau pressure that we measure. So this disease process, like virtually all disease processes where we put patients on ventilators, is very inhomogeneous. So there are some lung units that have quite different time constants than other lung units. Now, the difference between the peak pressure and the plateau pressure is represented by the flow setting on the ventilator and the patient's airways resistance. I think it is valuable in these patients to follow over time the difference between the peak pressure and the plateau pressure, because that allows us to monitor at the bedside changes in the patient's airways resistance over time. So if we are aggressively treating the underlying disease process, we would hope that over time, the difference between the peak pressure and the plateau pressure would decrease. The difference between the plateau pressure and the level of PEEP set on the ventilator is determined by the respiratory system compliance and the tidal volume. So if we are concerned about the plateau pressure, the most immediate way of reducing the plateau pressure is to reduce the tidal volume. And then the other component of this that we need to think about in patients with obstructive lung disease, such as patients with asthma, is how much auto-PEEP there is. So how much end expiratory alveolar pressure is present in addition to the PEEP setting on the ventilator. And I've tried to draw this to illustrate that if the amount of auto-PEEP increases, then that will drive up the plateau pressure, that'll drive up the peak inspiratory pressure, and increase the risk of overdistension lung injury. On the other hand, if we decrease the amount of auto-PEEP, the effect will be to lower the plateau pressure and lower the peak inspiratory pressure. Now, just as we can apply an end inspiratory breath hold to measure alveolar pressure at the end of inhalation, we can apply an end expiratory breath hold to measure the auto-PEEP, to measure the alveolar pressure at end exhalation, and that's what we do when we measure auto-PEEP. So at this point, rather than having the ventilator deliver the next tidal volume of air into the lungs, at the end of exhalation, we produce an end expiratory breath hold, so the inspiratory and expiratory valves of the ventilator are both closed during this time, and if the pressure during this maneuver increases to some pressure greater than the PEEP set on the ventilator, that indicates that there is auto-PEEP that is present, and in fact, this is the maneuver that we commonly use at the bedside to quantify the amount of auto-PEEP. Now, again, it's important to appreciate that the auto-PEEP that we measure here is the average amount of auto-PEEP. And because of the inhomogeneity of the lungs, there may be some lung units that have more auto-PEEP than we get with this measurement, and other lung units that have less auto-PEEP than we get from this measurement. It's also important to appreciate that this maneuver, the traditional auto-PEEP maneuver on the ventilator, will only measure the amount of auto-PEEP that occurs in lung units where the airway is open at end exhalation. So let's look at that for a minute. So this is one of the classic papers that Ben listed a few minutes ago by Leatherman, and this, I think, is a very, I would really refer this paper to all of you. It gives, a lot of very helpful insights into the management of the ventilator in patients with asthma. So imagine that this cartoon represents the lungs of your patient on a ventilator who has asthma. And at end exhalation, the airway leading to this alveolus is closed. So during exhalation, this airway closes. So during exhalation, this airway closes when the alveolar pressure is 20 centimeters of water. And let's imagine that in this lung unit, this airway closes during exhalation when the alveolar pressure is 15 centimeters of water. So in other words, the auto-PEEP in this alveolus is 20. The auto-PEEP in this alveolus is 15 centimeters of water. The pressure in the alveolus at end exhalation, or the amount of auto-PEEP. Let's imagine that in this lung unit, this airway closes when the alveolar pressure is 13 centimeters of water. This alveolus has an auto-PEEP of 13. In this lung unit, however, the airway remains partially open at end exhalation, and the auto-PEEP here is 5 centimeters of water. Now, if we do our traditional auto-PEEP measurement on the ventilator, where we press the button on the ventilator and the inspiratory and expiratory valves both close at end exhalation, the auto-PEEP that we will measure will be 5 centimeters of water. So this patient could be grossly hyperinflated. This patient on chest film could have their diaphragm shoved down towards their hips and be hemodynamically unstable. And you would expect that they would have a lot of auto-PEEP, but when you measure it, you don't get a very high level of auto-PEEP. Because here we can only measure the amount of auto-PEEP through lung units or through airways that are open at end exhalation. So the important message here is that when we make auto-PEEP measurements in patients with severe acute asthma who are mechanically ventilated, the measurements that we make may be a gross underestimation of the true level of auto-PEEP in a number of lung units if there is airway collapse during exhalation. Now, a few more words about auto-PEEP and air trapping and dynamic hyperinflation. So auto-PEEP is the result of air trapping. It causes dynamic hyperinflation. So how do patients with asthma develop auto-PEEP on the ventilator? Well, the auto-PEEP is determined by two primary things. It's determined by the minute ventilation that we set on the ventilator, and it's determined by the patient's lung function. So if we ventilate the patient with a large tidal volume, that will drive up the minute ventilation. That will increase the amount of auto-PEEP. If we ventilate the patient with a high respiratory rate, that will shorten the expiratory time, and that will also contribute to more auto-PEEP. We can also try to manage the expiratory time and the amount of auto-PEEP by manipulating the inspiratory time and the I to E ratio. However, if you sit down and you can work through the math on your own, you can see that you will extend the expiratory time a lot more by lowering the respiratory rate than by playing around with the I to E ratio in the ventilator. So if your patient has a lot of auto-PEEP and you want to decrease the auto-PEEP, you want to think about decreasing the minute ventilation or allowing permissive hypercapnia, as one of those classic papers by Darioli that Ben listed on a previous slide illustrated nicely, now about 20 years ago, actually. Lung function affects the amount of auto-PEEP, resistance, and respiratory system compliance. So in the patient with asthma, the issue is the high airways resistance. Why are we concerned about auto-PEEP, or why is auto-PEEP a problem for our patients? Well, it drives up the plateau pressure, resulting in an overdistension, increases the work of breathing because it's much more difficult to breathe near total lung capacity. It can result in hemodynamic compromise because of the increase in intrathoracic pressure. It can result in air leaks and pneumothorax and subcutaneous emphysema and mediastinal air and so forth. And it can make it more difficult for the patient to trigger the ventilator, as I'll expand upon on the next slide. So then we correct minute ventilation, or we decrease minute ventilation by reducing the minute ventilation, as I said, allowing permissive hypercapnia, and aggressively treating the underlying lung function to decrease airways resistance. Now here's another one of those classic papers by Jim Leatherman, published just a few years ago in Critical Care Medicine, where he showed that in patients on the ventilator with asthma who are really tight, the expiratory flow, as we see here, so this is the expiratory flow with respect to time, the expiratory flow can almost approach an asymptote to zero flow. And I think you can appreciate here, if this is the expiratory flow pattern of your patient, you could extend the expiratory time way out to here, and the patient's still going to have some trapped gas. So rather than plan around with the settings on the ventilator here, what we really need to focus on is correcting the underlying lung function or improving airways resistance. So in this cartoon, I illustrate the problem with triggering the ventilator if you or if your patient has auto-PEEP. So what I show here is an airway with a high airways resistance. Imagine that this is an area of flow limitation within the lung. Here is the alveolus. Up here is the ventilator attached to the proximal airway. And at end exhalation, the pressure in the alveolus here is 10 centimeters of water. The pressure set in the ventilator circuit is zero. So in this case, the patient has an auto-PEEP of 10 centimeters of water. At end exhalation, the pressure in the alveolus is 10 centimeters of water greater than the pressure at the proximal airway. Now, in order for the patient to trigger a breath from the ventilator by the patient's inspiratory effort, the patient needs to generate enough inspiratory effort, decrease the pleural pressure enough to first overcome the auto-PEEP and then also to overcome the trigger sensitivity on the ventilator. So in this case, the patient would need to generate an inspiratory effort of at least 11 centimeters of water to trigger the ventilator. Now, if the patient can only generate an inspiratory effort of 5 centimeters of water, the patient will make an inspiratory effort, and the ventilator will not trigger a breath delivery. And in fact, a common clinical sign of auto-PEEP at the bedside is that you see the patient make inspiratory efforts that do not result in the ventilator triggering the beginning of inhalation. Now, if this is flow limitation, then what will happen is if we increase the PEEP setting within the ventilator circuit, the PEEP set in the ventilator circuit will have the effect of counterbalancing the auto-PEEP. So here we've increased the PEEP in the ventilator circuit to 7 centimeters of water. The end expiratory alveolar pressure is still 10, so we haven't increased the risk of overdistension or hemodynamic compromise. But the auto-PEEP, the difference in the pressure between alveolar pressure at end exhalation and the pressure in the ventilator circuit at end exhalation, is now only 3 centimeters of water. So the effect here is that it makes it easier for the patient to trigger the ventilator. Now the patient only needs to generate an inspiratory effort of 4 centimeters of water in order to trigger the ventilator. This also points out that in patients who have auto-PEEP, when we make the auto-PEEP measurement, we should set the PEEP on the ventilator to 0. Otherwise, we'll be fooled. So in this case, you would think the patient only has 3 centimeters of water of auto-PEEP, but if you take away the PEEP which is set on the ventilator and get the true auto-PEEP, as the auto-PEEP as that results from the patient's respiratory dysfunction, the true auto-PEEP is 10 centimeters of water. And I must say it took me a number of years till I figured this out myself, and that is that in patients who have auto-PEEP and flow limitation, the PEEP will counterbalance the auto-PEEP, and the auto-PEEP measurement that you make off the ventilator can really fool you unless you set the PEEP to 0. So then from a practical standpoint, how do we go about setting PEEP in patients with auto-PEEP? Well, what I do at the bedside is to increase the PEEP setting on the ventilator until there are no missed trigger efforts. So the benefit of using PEEP to counterbalance auto-PEEP is to make it easier for the patient to trigger the ventilator. So I simply increase the PEEP until the point at which every time the patient makes an inspiratory effort, the ventilator triggers the delivery of the next breath. Also, while I'm doing that, I monitor the plateau pressure and the peak inspiratory pressure. And I do not use any more PEEP than is necessary, or I don't use PEEP beyond which the plateau pressure and the peak inspiratory pressure increase. In other words, if I turn up the PEEP and the plateau pressure and the peak inspiratory pressure go up, that tells me that the PEEP is no longer counterbalancing auto-PEEP, but now it's simply contributing to a greater degree of overdistension. Now, there was this actually very nice paper published in Critical Care Medicine about 2 years ago now, where it showed that in patients with asthma on the ventilator, there are actually three different types of responses that a patient may have to increasing the amount of PEEP set on the ventilator. They describe some patients where when they increase the amount of PEEP set on the ventilator, the amount of air trapping and overdistension actually went down. And then they describe some patients where when they added PEEP from the ventilator, the PEEP counterbalanced the auto-PEEP, and the plateau pressure and the peak inspiratory pressure really did not start to go up until the PEEP set on the ventilator equaled the amount of auto-PEEP. In other words, the PEEP set on the ventilator was 100% of the auto-PEEP. And then they described other patients in whom when PEEP was increased on the ventilator, immediately it drove up the plateau pressure, the peak inspiratory pressure, and the volume of trapped gas. In other words, these were patients where using PEEP actually made the degree of hyperinflation worse. So how do you know then if your patient will behave like this, or like this, or like this? I think you have to do an N of one experiment at the bedside to determine what your patient's response to PEEP will be. And I would argue that if your patient's response to PEEP is like this one, you may be better off keeping the PEEP set at virtually zero, at a very low level. Whereas in these patients, using PEEP effectively to counterbalance auto-PEEP. So let me show you some graphics from some real patients. So this is a patient who has auto-PEEP. Here we're looking at flow at the proximal airway. This is inspiratory flow above zero, expiratory flow below zero. Here we're looking at airway pressure. In this patient, I placed an esophageal balloon. So we're looking also at esophageal pressure, the esophageal pressure reflecting changes in intrapleural pressure. And the first thing that you can appreciate here is that there are places here, 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 with each of the arrows, where the patient makes an inspiratory effort, decreasing the intrapleural pressure, but the ventilator does not deliver a breath. I would also argue that you really don't need the esophageal balloon here. You would know that the patient has auto-PEEP because the patient, by looking at the patient, you would see the patient making inspiratory efforts where the ventilator doesn't deliver a breath. And if you look at the expiratory flow pattern, every time the patient makes an inspiratory effort that does not trigger, you see this little notching in the expiratory flow pattern. And you can also see that at end exhalation, on none of these breaths does the flow return to zero. So there's still gas coming out of the lungs at end exhalation, indicating that there is air trapping and auto-PEEP. We can actually use the esophageal pressure tracing to determine the amount of auto-PEEP by looking at the amount of decrease in intrapleural pressure that is required to trigger the ventilator. And in this way, we can get auto-PEEP in a spontaneously breathing patient or in a patient triggering the ventilator. Here, the auto-PEEP that we measure is the least amount of auto-PEEP that the patient has. So in other words, this represents flow into the lung units, or the triggering of the breath represents flow into the lung units that have the least amount of auto-PEEP. Here is another patient who has auto-PEEP. On the tracing at the top, we have the PEEP setting on the ventilator is 0 centimeters of water, so there's no PEEP that is set. Here we do our auto-PEEP measurement. So this is the amount of auto-PEEP that the patient has, which comes out to be about 10 centimeters of water. So the patient has about 10 centimeters of water of auto-PEEP. The plateau pressure is about 22 centimeters of water. The peak inspiratory pressure is about 35 centimeters of water. In the bottom tracing, what we've done is to increase the PEEP from 0 up to 8 centimeters of water set on the ventilator. So now there's a PEEP here at 8 centimeters of water. And notice that in this case, the PEEP very nicely counterbalances the auto-PEEP because we increase the PEEP setting on the ventilator, and the plateau pressure is still about 22 centimeters of water, and the peak pressure is still about 35 centimeters of water. So in this case, we have increased the PEEP, counterbalanced the auto-PEEP. We have not produced additional hyperinflation because the peak and the plateau have not changed. Just a word about discontinuation of ventilatory support in these patients, and then I'll turn the podium back over to Ben. So first of all, we want to aggressively treat the underlying disease process, then withhold any sedation that the patient may be receiving. Do a very short spontaneous breathing trial, about 30 minutes, I think, is adequate. During that spontaneous breathing trial, I think it's important to avoid providing a heated or a cool mist of water or saline to the airway because that can be a trigger for the patient's asthma. Then when we extubate the patient, again, avoid any irritating cool mist to the airway, and remember to continue to aggressively treat the lung function after we take out the endotracheal tube. So Ben is going to tell us about sedation and paralysis.
All right, so in the last 15, 20 minutes we have, we'll go through some of the ancillary therapies when we're managing these patients. And the first thing, actually, we were talking about maybe we should have put this before the mechanical ventilation component, because this is actually one of the first things you have to think about. And I think it's in the inexperienced hands, a lot of our residents see when you intubate an asthmatic, they almost suddenly say, oh, okay, now that the tube's in, they're being ventilated, things should be taken care of. And it's the vent is really just a tool. It hasn't treated anything. And in fact, if you don't aggressively manage the patient at that point, the vent may make things worse, as you've just heard. So I think part of what has to happen in this is to then aggressively try to treat the underlying problem. And one of the things that I think is commonly overlooked is sedating the patient and paralyzing the patient if need be. These patients tend to be young, strong, with an incredible drive to breathe. And one of the problems is once they get a little support from the ventilator, they'll really start to take in good volumes again. And in addition to all the things that does in terms of air trapping and barotrauma, one of the things it can do is increase dead space. So the CO2 will rise in these patients, thus causing further respiratory drive. And you can get into this cycle where the patient is just impossible to put down and get them to slow their respiratory rate. So first thing I do with these patients after I intubate them, and when I tell residents if it's over the phone, is to aggressively sedate the patient. And I like propofol for that. It's really been the best drug that I've used for that because it's such a good sedating drug, and it has bronchodilating qualities to it that help also. It's basically general anesthesia. The problem, of course, is that it's frequently associated with hypotension. So I tell when we're about to intubate a patient, we get good access, run IV fluids, and pretty much just have Levofed ready, if not already running in these patients, because they will drop their pressure quickly. It's amazing to me how often the bad asthmatic, propofol is just not enough to get them in sync with the ventilator. So the next step is really adding other agent. Narcotics are also great for suppressing the respiratory drive, and avoiding morphine, I think, is a good idea because of the potential of histamine release. Benzos also help. Ketamine also has bronchodilating effects. I just don't use it. There is this theoretical increased secretion risk, as well as increased intracranial pressure with, if you're going to be using permissive hypercapnia, is actually quite a significant issue because your CO2 can be quite high in that situation. But I'd have to say a good 20 to 30% of asthmatics, even with heavy, heavy sedation, you just can't get in sync with the ventilator. And in this case, I think although you want to avoid paralytics at all costs in these patients because of the increased risk of prolonged paralysis and myopathy, a bolus of paralytics actually goes a long way in this situation. So just and we like Nimbex because it seems to have the best safety profile in these patients. But if you can get just on top of these patients for 15, 20 minutes, get them in sync with the ventilator, you can blow off some of that CO2, and as the paralytic wears off, now their pH is a little better, their CO2 is a little better, they're a little more relaxed, and you can kind of get them in sync with the ventilator, and you don't have this problem of every time they get a little light that they're going to breathe fast and pop off the vent, et cetera. So I do think the first step when I'm start to ventilate a patient is heavy, heavy sedation and often the use of paralytics in bolus therapy. I would not use drips in these patients, and I don't think I've used a drip in quite a long time of a paralytic for these patients, if possible. You should be able to, with short-term paralysis and heavy sedation, get on top of them in that situation. Now, other ancillary therapies, now I put some evidence-based studies, and a lot of these are not, some is probably an overstatement, but we had actually forgot to put IV corticosteroids and just added it at the last second, and then I put, of course, you're going to treat these people with IV corticosteroids. How much? A lot, I would say. We could probably get a poll and get different things. I think at least 240 milligrams of Medrol a day. I would treat IV in these patients. There's no reason to use oral plus. If you're going to have them intubated or need to intubate a patient, you want at least the stomach as empty as possible. Some people use 125 Q4 or Q6. I think at least 80 Q8 is probably what I'd say, and often I use more when doing that. Bronchodilators also, of course, in this it's a mainstay of therapy. Beta agonists, and in the patients this sick, I think the data for anticholinergics is that it adds a little bit. And since a little bit may go a long way in someone who's quite severely ill, we have used combination therapy in this and often go to continuous nebulizations, which we'll talk about. Now, IV bronchodilator therapy, if you look at the data, there's really no data offering strong support for its use. And I used to be like dead set against it when I started. Like often when you start, you read two papers and you say, no, you never use it. And then when you gain some experience, you realize, wrong all those years. But where I consider it is when the patient just can't get good volumes, and there just are some patients you can't deliver enough inhaled bronchodilators, at least I believe, and you have to switch to IV. When I use IV, I use epinephrine. I think there's a theoretical benefit to using a little alpha in these patients for airway edema, plus it helps with some of the blood pressure effects you may have. Low dose, 0.5 to 1, somewhere around there. You can stop the nebulized therapy at that. You should be saturating your beta receptors at that point. Theo and other methylxanthines I don't think are used much, certainly not at Mass General anymore. There are reports of leukotriene receptor antagonist IVs being used, but I don't think that's available for common use. So magnesium I'll mention. It's cheap. It's relatively safe. May or may not help. But why not? These people are sick, and I'll show the data for that. And then, you know, at that point, you're really getting into just case report, anecdotal experience. I'll talk just briefly about inhaled corticosteroids in this situation, airway clearance, a lot of old papers talking about this mucus plugging, getting in there and removing those plugs. I can tell you bronching these patients is not easy by any means. And when I've had to bronch patients for other reasons with bad asthma flares, it can be quite difficult. Mucolytics, obviously Mucomist can be used. There is some bronchoconstrictive effects of that, so obviously use careful. Chest PT, I haven't been convinced of any data. In fact, there's some things that say it may make things worse. Buffer therapy, I'm all for. I used to have the three-call rule. If I got more than three calls from residents or nurses about a pH, then I'd say, well, we'll go ahead and start buffer. It's amazing over the years. I think we managed one asthmatic who is one of the case reports with a pH of 6.9 to 7 for a day and did fine. So you get comfortable with low pHs, but some people don't. And if you want to, the kidney is going to retain bicarb anyway after a while. Why not bring it up slowly? I don't do bolus therapy, but I don't have a problem with bicarb, and I'll show a little data with that. Inhalational anesthesia I won't discuss. Difficult to do. Maybe some theoretical advantage of direct bronchodilator qualities, but I think propofol achieves many of the things you'd want, and I'll talk briefly on Heliox also. So just some data on IV bronchodilator therapy. This is just looking at the safety of epinephrine. It's just a case series where they looked at 20-something patients, I guess, that they gave IV epinephrine to. Their conclusion was it was safe, which was interesting because they had adverse events of 10, 13, percent here, which is, seems quite high to me. If you add it up, it's like 30-something percent. But for the most of them, they're not too bad. Sinus tach, hypertension, some tissue ischemia in local sites where they were infusing it. And these people tend to be young, and so will tolerate IV epi. There is obviously this risk of myocardial ischemia and other problems with arrhythmias. So I think they excluded people over age 55, which is probably not a bad idea. But it can be used safely if you are careful with it. And I really think about it in situations where your minute volume is so low, tidal volume is less than 300 or 250, where you're just not sure you're delivering bronchodilators by the airway. And epi has that added vasoconstrictive effect, which affects that airway edema component. So I think that's another potential benefit of epinephrine. Magnesium, there was a Cochrane meta-analysis back in 2000, and then another small study in 2002 that seemed to suggest it helps in the severe asthmatics. It's quite easy to give, 2-gram dose. Some people have given up to 10 grams, and that can be associated with hypotension. But in the sort of 2 to 4-gram dose range, I think you can give it safely and use it with minimal side effects, and it's cheap. So I certainly don't have a problem doing it. If you've got one of these sick people and you feel like you're not doing anything for them, you can add this on and maybe you feel a little better about it. I'm not sure how much effect it will have. This is something that I stumbled upon a few years ago, and I've been using it again because it's relatively safe to do. And the idea here is that you're giving an inhaled corticosteroid, and the one I've been using in ventilated patient is nebulized budesonide. And there is this local effect of steroids of vasoconstriction. One of the ways they do potency is skin blanching with this. And in fact, if you squirt it on the airways, people have shown directly that you can reduce the edema within minutes. And that's a non-genomic effect, so systemic corticosteroids would not have that effect, whereas the systemic would do all this here. So the question in my mind is whether you get the steroid to the area where it's going to have that effect. That is the real big question. It certainly will get in the endotracheal tube, and it will get into the trachea, whether it gets further down there. But again, it's probably a small little addition to your regimen, may have an effect, not too problematic in the management of the patient, certainly very few side effects. So, you know, you can add it in. But I would not, I certainly haven't seen any randomized trials showing it, although there have been people who have taken pictures after nebulized budesonide showing less airway edema in that situation. Buffer therapy, the knock against bicarb always was, well, certainly bolus bicarb can decrease your myocardial function, so I wouldn't do bolus bicarb, but the story you always heard was that it raises your CO2, which certainly can happen. The interesting thing is when people study this is just another case series, and you can see the pHs in this. This was pediatric literature, actually quite low in some patients. And not surprisingly, you give bicarb after an infusion of a day or so, the pH gets better. The interesting thing is not everybody's CO2 went up. Some did, but some actually went down for reasons that are not exactly clear. But you don't necessarily have to raise your CO2 too much. And in the end, you're really trying to target this pH issue here. So it can be effective as just a drip, D5W, 3 amps of bicarb, hang it at 150 an hour, or 200 an hour if you want. Tham is another option, which avoids this, theoretically, this issue of higher CO2s when you give it. It's just a little hard to dose. It kind of, sort of comes up, at least in our pharmacy, it's a big jug, and they hang it, and you wait an hour for it to run in, and then you say, now what? And their pH gets a little better. But I never know about redosing it. Heliox, just for time, I'm just going to just mention this. The advantage of Heliox, obviously, is this low density component to it. The problem is this thermal conductivity, which means that the vents, which use flow sensors that are heat activated, is that correct, Dean? It senses this as flowing faster than it actually is, so they deliver very small tidal volumes. So modern ventilators can't use helium in this sort of thing, so that's the difficulty. But this low density means that since the pressure varies with the density, the pressure to push certain flows will vary with the density. You can, by lowering the density, reduce the pressure to move turbulent flow. And in fact, it will convert turbulent flow to laminar flow because it lowers the Reynolds number in addition. And so in the case of an airway stenosis, where it's classically used and I think clearly beneficial, it will create laminar flow in this situation. I think that's why your voice gets squeaky when you inhale helium, and make it much easier to breathe through that stenosis. Whether it gets down to where the flow limitation is in an asthmatic, I guess, is where the debate is. Most of the experience, I'll just flip through this, is anecdotal. And I certainly have had patients that we ventilated with the old servo vents and Heliox who it's dramatic how much easier they are to ventilate once you put them on Heliox. And certainly have had people sitting there huffing and puffing, looking horrible. You slap a Helios mask on them, and they suddenly, you know, relax and look much better, talk to you in a squeaky voice at the same time. So, you know, a lot of sort of small studies with, you know, mainly the case report thing showing benefit with effects that would seem to imply that it's reducing obstruction. But when you look at larger studies and other smaller studies, there is no benefit. In fact, meta-analysis has not shown any benefit for Heliox in non-intubated patients, looking at sort of prevention of hospital admissions and lung functions. Again, in the severe asthmatic, if you can try it and avoid intubation, which I am convinced I've done in the past with some of these patients, it's worth a try. It has to be available quick, obviously, and our therapists are able to bullet it down to the ED. We used to keep some in the ED. We still do, yeah. And I think it's a great intervention in that, although physiologically I think you can make some arguments about it. For the sense of time, I'll just skip through this just to mention there is the idea that Heliox improves aerosol delivery and improves particle delivery, with some studies showing good effects, others showing not. And then this by an obscure author in Chest showing that it affects nebulizer function, calling into question all the previous studies on whether it really was improving aerosol delivery. So this, the jury is still out, but clearly it affects flow meters, jet nebulizers, ICU ventilators, non-invasive pressure ventilators. So if you use this, you got to know what you're using. And I think this is the servo vent, the only one that still can...
Yeah, there's one that's actually approved for Heliox.
One of the Hamilton ventilators is approved for Heliox. So you can use it if you... Do we have one of those? We do, thank God.
We've never used it.
We've never used it. All right, next month. So I'm going to turn it over to Dean for the last few minutes, and maybe we can breeze through the cases so we can finish on time.
So one of the questions that comes up in these patients is we want to deliver inhaled bronchodilators, and what is the best way to do that? Should we put a nebulizer in line with the ventilator circuit? Should we put a meter dose inhaler in line with the ventilator circuit? Will either work? Is one better than the other? Well, first of all, we need to remember in these patients, usually we need to deliver very high doses, higher than the typical doses that we would deliver during mechanical ventilation. And sometimes we even may want to deliver a continuous bronchodilator at a high dose to treat the patient's underlying bronchospasm. So from a standpoint of convenience, I think many times the nebulizer just turns out to be more convenient than the meter dose inhaler. You could stand there at the bedside as a respiratory therapist and actuate the meter dose inhaler with every breath to get cramps in your thumb, I guess, but it's a lot easier just to use the nebulizer. What does the evidence show? Well, this is from an evidence-based report published in Chest about 2 years ago now that concluded that both nebulizers and meter dose inhalers can be used to deliver beta agonists to mechanically ventilated patients. But whether you use a meter dose inhaler or a nebulizer, you need to pay attention to the details of the delivery. In other words, you need to make sure that you do it correctly. So I think the evidence would say you could use either a nebulizer or a meter dose inhaler. I think the convenience would say that a nebulizer is more convenient in these patients than a meter dose inhaler. Just a word about non-invasive ventilation. This is another one as Ben and I were looking at this right before we started. We said we should probably put this in at the beginning, but we didn't, so it's here now. So what evidence do we have for the use of non-invasive ventilation in acute asthma? The answer is not very much. There are case series in the literature which suggest benefit. There are case reports in the literature that suggest benefit. But to my knowledge, this is the only randomized controlled trial. This was a ED study of 30 patients with severe asthma who were randomized to either non-invasive ventilation or aggressive therapy without non-invasive ventilation. And they actually reported a very strong benefit for non-invasive ventilation. There was a more rapid improvement in the FEV1 with the use of non-invasive ventilation as compared to the control patients. And if you look at patients who did not require admission, there were a lot more of the patients, 12 out of 15 of the patients, in the BiPAP group who could be discharged from the ER as compared to only 5 of the patients who did not, out of 15 of the patients who did not receive BiPAP. So there is some evidence to support the use of non-invasive ventilation in patients with acute asthma, but the evidence base is anything but mature. And I think we have very little evidence from randomized controlled trials, essentially 30 patients, from what I know. So just as Ben got comfortable in his seat, he can come back and maybe buzz through these cases.
We're kind of at the end of the lecture time. I don't know if we should stop for questions or do we want
to... Okay,
so this actually was one of the ones I saw as an intern, so I had to do it by memory, so hopefully the numbers work out. It's largely, an amalgam of asthma case. But this was really the most severe asthmatic I've ever taken care of. A 19-year-old kid, poor compliance was the main problem. Intubated in the ED, started on volume-controlled ventilation, was very difficult to deliver adequate tidal volumes. They were popping off like crazy. And shortly after being intubated, I think it was a film 30 minutes later, they get a chest x-ray and he has bilateral pneumos and pneumomediastinum. Chest tubes were emergently placed. And he came, then he was like shuttled up to us as fast as you can believe, like he was a hot potato, like get him up to the MICU. So he came to us, he was still on his volume cycle, tidal volume set at 400 mil, his rate was 20 and his FI2 was 1, PEEP was set at 5, which almost all our patients get PEEP of 5. The problem, of course, was he was breathing and, 30 plus. Tidal volumes were at best 200 mil with each breath. With PIPs, he was popping off like crazy on the ventilator. And his blood gas was something like this. pH was in the 6.9 range. This was this person we managed all day with a pH of 6.9 in this patient. He had already gotten steroids. He was receiving continuous NEBS through the old Puritan-Bennett 7200 that we had. And the question really is, what's your first step with this? I don't know if people, we could open it up if people wanted to say what they would do in this situation.
For the sake of time.
time. All right. So, I mean, when we thought about this, the first thing, actually, heavily sedate the patient, paralyze. We ended up paralyzing this guy for sure. One of the things they had down in the ED was they had his flow only at like 40 or 50 and a descending waveform. So we switched him to square. We knocked off the PEEP, tried to maximize the expiratory time as best we could. It helped a little. And Dean and I sort of came up with the idea that, well, you know, you want the pH around 7.2, the plateau definitely less than 30, as low as possible, I think, because remember, it's an average, so you may be above that. And the auto PEEP, you know, we chose three. We initially had this as the VEI, which is Tuckson's maneuver, but that's tough to do in these patients. And why three? I'm not quite sure. I'd probably tolerate 5 to 10 if I had to, but I think we should always be trying to reduce the auto PEEP as low as possible. Now, if you can do that, then great. You know, continue and just give your NEBS, watch them on the steroids. If you can't, then, you know, I think switching to continuous bronchodilators, throw in your IV magnesium. At that point, recheck, not there yet. Well, you know, if your tidal volumes are really less than 300 mil, well, maybe this is a person you should be giving IV epinephrine in, and maybe start your buffer therapy at this point. I think that would be a reasonable thing to do. Still not there, which was the point with this guy, and this was one of these people we switched over to a Heliox vent, and it was his pH immediately came up to 7.2 within, I think, 20 minutes of ventilating this guy, and its volumes came up. It was just really incredible. And then, you know, this may be someone, if you're not getting anything, to go down and opening up the lung a little bit by doing it. I don't have PEEP titration in here because I think when you have someone this sick, it's best just to leave the PEEP off. They're so puffed up at this point. It probably is not going to help, although there are these people that you maybe could recruit units, as that one study showed. And then if you're going nowhere, we've had, I think, one or two patients we've had to go to ECMO to actually manage the patient's CO2s in the 200s or so and couldn't do it. This actually we have as a handout, which is kind of a flow chart that we made up. We had actually made years ago, and we've modified it a bit, which would look at these sort of things and go through and kind of help you kind of do this. Since you'll have it as a handout, you can look at it. And the final case I just wanted to mention, and then this will take just 2 seconds, was a very influential case I had as a resident in a woman who actually was a MICU nurse who had a long history of refractory asthma, chronic steroid use, intubated in the ED, and then came up to us. And really the impressive thing was she wasn't that bad on the ventilator. And I think that always has to make you wonder about the underlying process. Now, she did have a PIP to plateau of 10, and have some auto PEEP. She did probably have some mild asthma, but was it really bad enough to get her intubated? And in fact, when the workup continued, she really was someone with vocal cord dysfunction. And I think one of the clues when you ventilate these people is if you can, you know, intubate the patient and they're suddenly better, you have to think about this. And this fools a lot of people still to this day, intubating these people. And they, you know, when I occasionally cover at other hospitals and things like that, it's amazing how many of these bad asthmatics probably have this, who get intubated and then are, you know, you look and they're extubated in a day or things like that. So why don't we stop there? We can answer any questions. There's time for discussion, yes. Correct?
Great. Thank you very much.
Oh, summary slide, but we'll skip that.